May it please the court. Defendants have raised two core issues in this post-remand appeal. First, several provisions in the modified injunction are inconsistent with the panel opinion and violate the mandate rule. The court should vacate or modify those provisions for the reasons explained in the court's post-remand decision in O'Donnell v. Goodhart. Second, defendants respectfully ask the court to reconsider its prior ruling upholding an order that requires the creation of an electronic record system that plaintiffs never asked for and no expert testified was necessary to remedy any constitutional violation. Starting on the first issue, I'd like to focus on the application of the mandate rule to two particularly significant provisions. First is the order expanding awake night supervision beyond the foster group home context. And the second is the order prohibiting ICU workers from performing their role of visiting temporarily displaced children.
And your argument on the first one, one of your arguments is that it would, by its own terms, it would even apply to private homes to which it wasn't ever intended. Is that right? I mean, is that...
Well, one of our concerns about this is the kinship placement context.
Right.
Plaintiffs suggest that maybe the order should be interpreted not to apply there, but that just begs the question of, well, then where did the district court intend it to apply?
We should at least clarify that. Is that what you're saying?
What we would say is under the mandate rule, there was no reason for the district court to revisit this whatsoever because the panel opinion did not adjudicate the validity of awake night supervision. The concern about awake night supervision was uniquely limited to the foster group home context, and the panel opinion did not invite the district court to go expand awake night supervision beyond foster group homes into other placements where the lack of awake night supervision was never raised by the plaintiffs as a concern and never addressed by the district court. This is very similar to the situation in O'Donnell, where the court said remand is not the time to bring new issues that could have been raised initially. And that's the situation here. There was nothing in the permanent injunction about awake night supervision at all. And so there was no basis for the district court to expand on that. And I think it's key on that point. The plaintiffs in their briefing to the district court on the limited remand did not ask the district court to expand awake night supervision. The district court came up on this. So I think plaintiffs implicitly understood that this was not something that was on the table as the result of the panel opinion. And it's also worth pointing out, I think, that the plaintiffs, although we discussed O'Donnell at significant length in our brief, they don't cite it at all. They have no response to that whatsoever. On the other issue, application of the mandate rule, I mentioned is the ICU workers and the order mandating that only primary caseworkers can perform the monthly visitations to children. The panel opinion invalidated an injunctive order that would have eliminated ICU workers and required them all to be converted to primary caseworkers. And so by prohibiting ICU workers from performing the very role that their position was created, their entire purpose, the district court has effectively reinstated a provision that the panel invalidated.
You're suggesting we should look to the function, not the title of the person. Is that right?
I think that's correct. I think it's what's important about the panel decision in this regard is if the panel did have some criticisms about the application of the ICU program, specifically it noted that ICU workers are not the equivalent of primary caseworkers, and so when you're counting them, for statistical purposes, you can't include them in the count, and that's fine, but that's, if the court had intended to eliminate the ICU program altogether, I think it would have said so, and it certainly would not have invalidated the injunctive provision that did that very thing. And I think it's also important to note that the court appeared to recognize the important role that ICU workers serve because when these children are inevitably, through no fault of the states, forced to go to these placements outside of their home county for some kind of emergency treatment or something like that, due to the nature of Texas as being very geographically spread out, and the specialized treatment programs do tend to be clustered near major cities, which makes sense. That's the inevitable consequence, is that you've got these great distances that arise, and the ICU program was created in order to avoid the problem of the primary caseworker having to travel that enormous distance and wasting a lot of time and resources doing that. Now, the plaintiffs have suggested an alternative of this secondary primary caseworker, but that's not something that DFPS thinks is a good idea. In our view, that's really robbing Peter to pay Paul, in the sense that now you have what they're calling primary caseworkers who presumably have their own caseload of children, and now you're asking them to take on this additional task of doing what the ICU workers do and do very well.
What do the ICU workers do?
What the ICU workers do, Judge Higginbotham, is they visit the children who have been temporarily displaced, and they establish connections with the caregivers in these residential treatment facilities, for example, and they can do it very efficiently because they can be located very close to these facilities and establish a relationship with the caregivers.
I got the sense from the record that they were, I'm not suggesting not essential, given where we are, they are being sure the child is where they think they are. I see you, as the thing, the acronym you pulled here makes it pretty clear. And some of these things were very, very brief. The interviews were on 5-10 minutes. They were in and out. In other words, they by definition are doing something that far less than the caseworker. It's a supplementary device for the caseworker. Are you suggesting that, by your description, that the ICU workers are, in a lot of situations, are doing the work of a caseworker, or is it supplementary too, and if what is it?
They are supplementary, Judge Higginbotham. We're not saying they do all the work of a caseworker. They certainly don't. I would take issue with one of plaintiff's own witnesses talked about ICU workers spending an hour or so every month visiting with the children. That was Sandra Carpenter, who ran the evidence
is not uniform across them, but there was significant evidence that from the workers themselves, that their frustration, their high turnover rate because of the difficulties of just locating, getting out and finding the child. And so location was also a problem in that, confirming that they are, you know where they are.
And again, just to come back to the mandate rule here, the question is really—
Well, let's talk about the facts a second. We got to understand what the role of these people are. I got the distinct impression, and they so testified, they were being sure the child was where you thought they were.
Judge, you can
location, knowing where the child is.
Their role is to check in on the children. Yes, one of those functions is to make sure they're still there, but also to see how they're doing, to ask them if there's any issues with their placement. And I think to characterize that as just literally seeing if they're
not,
there is
I'm not trying to characterize it. I'm just trying to say, I'm giving back to you what the record says. I said.
Well, and something on that point, the panel opinion noted that ICU workers typically have 60 to 70 children on their caseload per month. That sounds like a lot, but when you break it down, if you figure that there are 20 working days in a month, that breaks down to about 3 to 3.5 children per day. If the caseworkers were really only spending 5 minutes with the children, they would be finished with their job before 9 a.m. So I think that's something, again, and looking at the mandate rule, the question here is, did the panel opinion contemplate the end of the ICU program as we know it? I think the answer to that question is clearly no.
Well, aren't they necessary to fulfill the face-to-face requirement?
They absolutely are, Judge Clement. Unless the court has further questions about the ICU program or the application of the mandate rule, I'd like to spend some of my remaining time on the computer system order because it's a...
Before you get to that's an important issue, and I do want you to address that. One of the issues that you've raised in your supplemental brief is entitled, "The Termination Order is Inconsistent with Rule 60B," and there you complain of the 3-year provision for supervision by the court. Without getting into the merits of that, I went back as late as this morning and looked at your initial panel brief in this case filed last year. I don't find anywhere that specific issue has been properly presented or presented at all to us on appeal at the initial stage. Is it there somewhere that I've missed it?
You did not miss it, Judge Smith. You're correct. We'd ask the court to look at it, but if the court declines to do so.
Okay, well, I won't take any more time about it. I just want to be sure I hadn't missed something. Okay, go ahead and turn to the computers.
There are three reasons why we are asking the court to reconsider its prior order upholding this, and three reasons the court should invalidate this order. First is reading an enormous volume of paper records is a very poor way to judge the efficacy of an electronic record system. Second of all, the federal government, specifically the Children's Bureau, the Department of Health and Human Services, really likes the IMPACT system and has given it thumbs up in two specific ways. And the third is that the computer system order is a logistical nightmare for DFPS, particularly on the one-year timeline that the district court has imposed. Now, starting on that first point, the court will recall that this order arose from the district court's frustration at reviewing 350-some-thousand printed pages of the named plaintiff's case files from IMPACT. But I would...
It also came from the, in this record, from the workers in the field that could not locate records and find out where these kids were. I mean, it's not just the district court doing that. That really shorthands tremendously. What I thought the record was that, and caseworkers, the ICU workers, your large turnover rate, part of the record that they were frustrated because they couldn't access the system, the record you have. Whoever praised it, your workers aren't praising it. And of course, I read the record.
In fact, our workers do praise. They like the IMPACT system. It's a very good tool. They have access to it on their tablets. They also have access to class and to the health passport system. But I would say in any state foster care system, you're certainly going to find instances of caseworkers not being able to put their hands on things immediately. That's an inevitable result of, as we're in various institutions, we're transforming from a paper world to an electronic world. And the reality is that that takes money. The federal government has been on top of this and has given the states money to bring their electronic data systems along. And it's undisputed that Texas is SACWIS compliant. That's the statewide automated child welfare information system that the Children's Bureau has developed. It started in the early 90s, and the program essentially phased out in 2016.
But as I understand your supplemental brief, you said that no other state has or has been required to have the kind of comprehensive system that was ordered here.
We're not aware of any. The plaintiffs haven't pointed to any that say this is an analog. Other states certainly have electronic record systems, and we do as well. But this kind of integrated system requiring all the records from these different areas to be streamlined into a single system, we're not aware of that being required of any other state. And it's really, again, if our system were really that bad, it's unclear how we would be both SACWIS compliant and also that IMPACT would be rated a strength by the Children's Bureau in the 2016 CFSRs. Now, the plaintiff's response to that is to try to conflate this court's discussion of the 2014 CFSRs in the panel opinion, which the court noted were preliminary and based entirely on state-reported data. But the court dismissed the 2014 CFSR, but it's instead relied on the 2016 CFSR, the final one, which, as the court noted, followed an extensive on-the-ground evaluation by federal regulators. So it was after that on-the-ground evaluation that the Children's Bureau pronounced IMPACT a strength and found it to be substantially in compliance with all the federal requirements. And our point about this is, again, the Children's Bureau is developing and has developed specific standards for foster care information systems to meet, and we would say if Texas is complying with those and its system is moving along, again, it's not a perfect system, but I don't think any state has a perfect system here, and we would urge the court to let the federal agency process do its work, and particularly if the concern is here that this is a way to help caseworkers who are overburdened, the court's already addressing the overburdened caseworker problem by the workload study that's going to result in the reasonable caseloads. And so if you have caseworkers that have reasonable caseloads, they can use these systems. They know how to use the impact system and the other systems. I see my time has expired.
So you've saved time for rebuttal. Thank you, Mr. Hughes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yep.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Paul Yetter for the plaintiff children. The panel upheld the district court's findings of a constitutionally defective Texas foster care system in two key areas, caseload management and monitoring and oversight. The opinion of the panel validated certain remedies as well that were narrowly tailored to facilitate corrections based on a simple premise. And this premise was that proper supervision of foster children by the state of Texas requires two minimal predicates: adequate resources and reliable information. Reliable information, in turn, has itself certain minimal requirements, and those are that it be full and complete and comprehensive, to use the panel opinion's words, otherwise it won't be reliable, that it be correct and accurate, or it won't be reliable, and that it be available, usable, and accessible so that it can be relied upon. The state's complaints today to the court about the remand order seek to undermine narrowly tailored remedies that the district court has ordered on remand that are fully consistent with the panel opinion to a system that's been adjudicated to be constitutionally defective. We respectfully submit that the order on remand should be affirmed in all respects. Unless the court has other preferences, I will deal with the issues that the state raised in their opening presentation. And I'm going to do it in a slightly different order. The order on remand that monthly visits, these critical monthly visits to children, be done by primary caseworkers that the district judge put in her remand order is entirely, precisely consistent with this court's panel opinion. Because primarily, in the panel opinion, this court affirmed, validated the district court's finding that ICU workers are, quote, inadequate substitutes for primary caseworkers to do these critical monthly child visits. And recall, as the panel certainly does, that these child visits are vital to safety. They build trust with the children. They allow the children to express concerns that they have in private conversations, to convey these concerns for a qualified primary caseworker to evaluate the children and to help with placement and advocacy for the children in the future. The panel opinion went through a very detailed assessment of what the district court had found as a matter of fact with regard to the ICU worker visits, and the panel opinion said, quote, by no means are ICU workers adequate, reasonable, or appropriate substitutes for primary caseworkers, that their visits are, quote, perfunctory, that their visits provide, quote, superficial and unhelpful information.
I don't hear the state saying that they're complete substitutes for the regular caseworkers.
But, Judge Smith, what the district judge below said is, if we're going to have true monthly visits with children, they can't be drive-by sightings. And that's what she found, as a matter of fact, that this panel affirmed, that the ICU workers were simply doing sightings, ICU, and that primary caseworkers do substantive visits with the children. And so what this panel upheld is the district court's findings as a matter of law that ICU workers cannot do and are not doing true monthly visits with the children. And so on remand, consistent with this court's panel order, the district judge said, well, then who should do the monthly visits? And this panel said, by no means are ICU workers adequate, reasonable, or appropriate to do the monthly visits. So what the district court said is, well, then primary caseworkers should do them. Now, this court and the district court acknowledged that it is difficult and is, I think, in this court, in the panel opinion's words, often impracticable for the primary caseworker assigned to a child to travel to if the child is placed in a different region, to travel to go visit that child. And so what the district court's order on remand does is allows local primary caseworkers, wherever that child has been placed, far away, to do this critical job of monthly visits. Now, why is that appropriate? And first, it's completely consistent with the panel opinion. But it's appropriate because these primary caseworkers are trained to be primary caseworkers. That's the job they've chosen, that's the job they've been trained to do, and that's the job they do every single day. Now, is it going to be a burden, as the state says? This panel validated the district court's order, in fact, mandated that we have to have reliable information, and so that means a reliable workload study, and that means if primary caseworkers out of region are going to also be looking at children that are not their specific, assigned specifically to them, but to do it for others, then that will be factored into the workload. And so if they have that greater burden of additional child visits, that will be part of the workload. And so their caseload will be adjusted accordingly. But the key thing, Judge Smith, and to this panel, is that the panel affirmed a fact finding by the district judge that ICU workers are inadequate. So what do these ICU workers do now? The state can reassign them to do jobs within this very vast system that these ICU workers with admittedly less training are able to do. They don't have to be fired. The district court didn't say eliminate ICU workers. The district court said instead, let's focus on the children, and monthly visits are critical, and let's have the appropriate, and I think Judge Smith, you asked, should we focus on the function of the workers? And I think that's exactly what the district court did, is the caseworkers, the primary caseworkers, are the ones that do the monthly visits.
But in reality, aren't there just not enough primary caseworkers?
Well, Judge Clement, that's exactly what the panel opinion is going to deal with, because the panel opinion, in saying proper supervision depends on adequate resources and reliable information, said the problem with caseworkers is that the state doesn't know how many it needs because it's refused to do workload studies. And secondly, that the state has not got any internal agency guidelines for caseloads. And so Judge Clement, if there's not enough caseworkers, and that is a constitutional defect of this system, which this panel has held, then the state needs to know how many does it need, and it needs to, in its hiring goals, take that into account. And so the district judge understands that these children, and this panel affirmed the ruling, that these children need adequate resources to be properly supervised. And so the panel said, the district court had originally said, let's put caseload caps, but the panel said, no, let's let the state have flexible internal agency guidelines for caseloads, but it has to be based on reliable information. And so this panel has already dealt with that issue, Judge Clement, we respectfully believe. And so to draw a conclusion to this, the district court would have issued a ruling contrary to the panel's ruling if it had said that the by no means adequate ICU workers should continue to do these vital monthly child visits.
What do they do, the ICU workers, under your understanding of the district court's order?
The district court does not mandate that they do anything in particular. It's totally up to the state. These are secondary workers for the state, and they have been trained to do a variety of things, presumably. But the state has alleged that one of the things they clearly do is make a sighting of a child. I see you, their name, is exactly what they do. They have not, and in fact, the panel opinion points out that contrary to state policy, they are not holding even private monthly meetings with children. And so children that have a reason to outcry, that are being abused, physically, sexually, whatever, without a private meeting with a trained caseworker are not able to convey that information. So what these ICU workers do now, Judge Smith, is going to be entirely up to the state. The state can train them to do whatever they want them to do as a secondary worker. But what the district court said is that monthly visits are vital. It's part of proper supervision and care that the state is constitutionally obligated to give. And so primary caseworkers must do those monthly visits. It's just that simple. And we respectfully submit that this court's panel opinion is utterly clear that proper supervision requires adequate resources and reliable information, and that's exactly what the district court in this respect was accomplishing, and we believe did accomplish. The second point, it was actually the first point that the state brought up on their first presentation, was about 24-hour supervision. The district court, following the panel opinion, we believe very carefully and faithfully, noted that the panel opinion had essentially validated and that the earlier motions panel ruling on the stay had validated the what the motion panel called the vast record reflecting the, quote, grave problems created by the lack of supervision of groups of more than six foster children, which is very unique to Texas, and the problems that they can cause to each other. And at the time of trial and at the time of the original injunction, the only facility that the state used to house groups of 7 to 12 foster children were called foster group homes. And the district judge ordered that they must require 24-hour supervision. Again, this is perfectly, we believe, completely consistent with the panel's decision that proper supervision requires adequate resources and reliable information. And essentially, these children, 7 to 12 children grouped in a home, and the record reflected even more than that, were being unsupervised for parts of the day, and it was primarily at night. The state said, we've complied. And the panel opinion said, well, that ends the issue. On remand, the district judge said, the danger still exists because the state, again, the evidence reflects, the record reflects, unique in the entire country, has a practice of housing 7 to 12 foster children together without 24-hour supervision. And so the district judge, ruling to protect the general class, said that if the state decides that it wants to house 7 to 12 foster children together, it has to provide constant supervision. There's no other state in the country that does what Texas does, that allows them for periods of the day, and at night bad things happen, to be unsupervised. There is nothing in the panel opinion that said the state is permitted to allow 7 to 12 children to be housed together without supervision.
Talk about the problem, if there is one, with the kinship placements.
And that's a very simple problem, Judge Smith. In the district judge's original injunction in January 2018, the court had issued essentially a broad prohibition of housing 7 to 12 children without 24-hour supervision. And the state said, well, at the time, the state objected and said, Judge Jack, this could cover kinship placements. And Judge Jack said, and the state points this out in their briefing, Judge Jack said, I understand your objection is sustained. It doesn't cover kinship. The state could very easily have told the district judge here, Judge Jack, you forgot to exclude kinship. There is no indication in her order or in anything the district court has ever done that her rulings are intended to apply to kinship placements, unlicensed kinship placements. If this court believes that that can't be cleared up by the district judge in its affirming the order on remand, they could certainly simply say that the 24-hour supervision rule does not cover unlicensed kinship placements. But there's nothing that indicates the district judge ever was trying to cover that. Now, I will say, on one last point on the 24-hour supervision, changing the name of what you call these groupings of 7 to 12 children does not change the risk. If you are not supervising them, the state is not upholding its obligation to keep these children safe. And so, a rose by any other color, a dangerous practice or policy for children by any other name is just as dangerous. Whether they call it foster group homes or cottage homes, the district judge was not focused on the name that the state put on it, but rather on the practice. And the unrebutted, undisputed, and perhaps even at this point admitted danger of housing that many children together and letting them be unsupervised for periods of time. Let me turn to the computer system point that the state has raised, and it's really two points together that are related. I suggested at the outset of my argument that the panel's decision was frankly very simple in terms of what the state needed to do. To properly supervise and care for these children, it needed adequate resources and reliable information. Two pieces of that is that the panel, I think both sides agree, the panel intended to validate the district judge's order that the state provide complete, comprehensive was the panel's word, medical and health care information for children. How many of us would go to a doctor asking for life-altering services from a physician that doesn't have our complete medical records? Or how many of us would feel comfortable housing children, and how could the state possibly today suggest to this court that they can make safe placement decisions if they don't have complete mental health information about the children? And so one of the things the state has objected to is the district judge telling the state, you now have to have reliable information, you have to have complete information, comprehensive information. And in fact, this panel's opinion upheld remedies that made it very clear what the panel said were called crossover provisions that said exactly that you had to have comprehensive. Because what this panel said, unlike what the state is now arguing on its, what is essentially a motion for reconsideration at this stage, is that it really does have a pretty good record-keeping system. What this panel said, and I'm quoting, is that the record-keeping system of the state of Texas was, quote, shockingly haphazard, inefficient, woefully incomplete and outdated, not synchronized.
But Mr. Hughes argues to us that the state complies with the federal standards, and even if these are my words, but has been commended or approved by the in compliance with the federal standards.
Counsel certainly does, and he does it very effectively, and for the same reason that the district judge below, with all the facts in front of the district judge, just did not regard that. That should not be an issue in front of this panel.
Assume that it is. What is your answer in terms of the federal standards?
Yes, because the federal standards, what the state is arguing is that one of its computer systems, called the IMPACT system, has passed the federal standards. The problem that this court has identified, and the district judge identified as well, is that the state has several computerized systems, one called IMPACT, one called CLASS, one called DFPS Forms, one called Star Health. Then they have lots of non-electronic data. All of these different sources are not integrated. And so, as this panel said, when a caseworker is looking to make a placement for a child, it's literally, to use the panel's words, a needle in the haystack scrutiny, child by child, every time the child has to make a placement. And so for the state to say, well, the federal government says one of our databases meets the minimum requirements of the federal standard, it looks at things through a microscope instead of holistically, because the problem is it's not integrated. And briefly, the state, outside the record, I would say, said no other state in the country has an integrated computer system. I'm going to say, and this is outside the record, that is not true. At least we know that Washington, D.C., Tennessee, and New Jersey have integrated computer systems that they have, that are currently, and there may be more, but that's what we have recently gone to verify. But the point is, these are not integrated. And integrated is something. How many businesses run effectively without having access to all of their data? And what this panel said is the data is not just not integrated because it's a needle in a haystack inquiry every single time. That's why these caseworkers are so overloaded. That's why they're so burned out. That's why there's so much turnover. This will save the state money, using technology to take the burden off the caseworkers, but more importantly, to make safe decisions for these children. It's not just a needle in a haystack exercise each single time. The needle is not even there many times, because as this panel said, it's woefully, the record-keeping system of the state is, quote, woefully incomplete and outdated. If you're looking, and there is evidence in the record of children that were injured because a caseworker had no way to know that it was placing an innocent child among other children that had a history of sexual abuse, This panel pointed out those examples in your panel opinion, and that's exactly why, if the state is going to protect these children, it needs adequate resources and reliable information, and you cannot have reliable information if it is not complete, if it is not accurate, and if it is not accessible. And a integrated, and that's the only thing the district judge has ordered, is an integrated system. It's not accessible. How do you, some of these records of abuse, now of course,
you can finish your sentence.
Some of these records of abuse, as the panel opinion points out, are not in any electronic form at all, or at least in only for one child, and so they're not accessible to a caseworker. So with respect, we believe that the district judge's order faithfully followed the panel opinion and should be affirmed in all respects. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Yetter.
Thank you.
Mr. Hughes, you save time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'd like to start back with the computer system order because that's where Mr. Yetter left off. This is not a narrowly tailored order. This is a best practice solution in search of a problem. I think it's really important to remember here that of all the complaints that the plaintiffs had about Texas's foster care system, nowhere did they complain about our computer system. None of their experts testified about it at all. And again, the federal government thinks we have a good system. Are there instances, individual instances, where records could be more easily laid hands on or where records are sometimes overlooked? Of course. But one problem is if the complaint, the district court's original complaint of having disorganized records, that's not even addressed by this order. This order does require the integration of a system, but the district court was complaining about this information overload. Well, you can bring in a lot more records at an enormous cost. You have to go out into private medical providers, you know, the community, you have to go out to educational systems and obtain more records. That's only going to increase the problem to just migrate these into one system at an enormous cost. And again, nobody has done any kind of calculation in this case about, is the game worth the candle? I mean, are we talking about $10 million, $50 million? Who knows? This is the problem of an issue that was never tried because it was never one of plaintiff's complaints, and here we're being subjected to it essentially because the special masters thought this would be a good idea. It's something that was on their wish list of things they'd like to see. To go back to a point I made earlier about the problem with judging the efficacy of an electronic database by using a printed paper record, if the court looked at, printed out the ROA from this case, it would be 50-some thousand pages. And if somebody sat down and went through every single page of the ROA in order to try to get a sense of how well PACER worked, nobody would argue that's a good way of evaluating PACER. PACER's a great system, and you can use it just like you can in IMPACT. It's got links and things like that that allow you to easily navigate through masses of documents. But essentially, that's what the district court did here, was to evaluate IMPACT by looking at 350-some thousand pages of printed material, not looking at how the electronic system actually works. And I would also add, to continue with the PACER analogy, it would be like reviewing the efficacy of PACER by having someone who is unfamiliar with appellate records do that review. Here, the district court acknowledged that it was untrained in reviewing case files. And so, again, we just think that this is a close look at how good our system is, was not taken in this case and was not proven by the evidence. I'd like to shift briefly to the orders about the ICU workers and awake night supervisions. If the panel had essentially intended to get rid of the ICU program, as I think plaintiffs have suggested, then it's inexplicable to me why it invalidated an order that did exactly that, which is the order that the district court has now effectively reinstated. And I would note that plaintiffs have not addressed in their argument today our point that if there are concerns about the qualitative nature of ICU workers, then our alternative suggestion of then make them subject to the same standards, qualitative standards, that primary caseworkers have in the CPS handbook. We'd be fine with that. because, again, we think that the IC workers do a good job and they serve a valuable role. The plaintiffs have argued that the solution here is to reassign these ICU workers. That's what the district court came up with in its permanent injunction, and that's the order that this court invalidated. One more thing about the ICU workers. These are not untrained workers. The ICU workers, the testimony in the record established, are largely former primary caseworkers with years, if not decades, of experience who decided to become ICU workers because they wanted to spend more time just visiting with children and to leave alone the other aspects of the job, like the court appearances and things like that. Just want to very quickly touch base on awake night supervision. Council talked at length about the issues with the lack of awake night supervision in foster group homes. That's not at issue in this appeal. We're not talking about foster group homes. We're talking about expanding awake night supervision into other different kinds of placements. And you can't just say that any placement that has more than six children is exactly like a foster group home when there's been no evidence.
Mr. Yetter today and also in his brief points out that it may simply be a matter of giving a different name to a facility, but it's really the same kind of facility. I mean, the same issue applies to the need for supervision. So what is your response to the suggestion that you're just giving it a different name so that it'll be okay?
If Mr. Yetter is talking about cottage family homes, as we pointed out in our brief, those are capped at six children. They can be expanded up to eight. So I don't think it's fair to just say those are exactly like foster group homes, which house 7 to 12 children. And furthermore, there's been absolutely no testimony, no evidence at all, that there's problems with operation of these cottage family homes. To my knowledge, there aren't any in operation in Texas. And the provisions he's talking about where, well, this could be an issue, there could be a rule, a path to expand the number of children. If that happens, they can bring a complaint. But they never raised any complaint about this in the lawsuit, even after the statute was passed allowing that. And the district court never made any findings. And the district court never said anything in the modified injunction invoking the cottage family homes or this legislation. This is a post hoc rationalization for the expansion of awake night supervision. Unless the court has further questions.
There aren't any kinship homes in Texas, you're saying?
No, cottage group homes, I think is what you said.
The cottage family homes, Judge Smith is correct. There are kinship placements, and I think plaintiffs have said that the order is not intended to apply there.
All right, thank you, Mr. Hughes. Your case and all of today's cases are under submission, and the court is in recess.